The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be talking about Yiddish. A book came out just recently called Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers in Language and Culture, and we'll be talking with two of the authors, Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman. This portion of the week is the portion of Mishpatim, can be found in chapter 21 of the book of Exodus. We have an awesome Hasidic story. Lots of good music. Yes, siree. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. This just in, a Molotov cocktail was thrown at an Israeli car near Modi'in. No injuries or damage was reported. Israeli soldiers were sent to search the area. An Arab stabbed a 30-year-old religious man in the neck at the Damascus Gate in Jerusalem. The injured man was evacuated in moderate condition to Shaare Tzedek Hospital and is expected to make a full recovery. The attacker was arrested immediately. Terrorists from Hamas-controlled Gaza fired a barrage of rockets towards Ashkelon. Five of the rockets were intercepted by the Iron Dome anti-missile system, which is what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to shoot down these areas. Several other rockets may have exploded in open areas. There was no reports of physical injuries or damage. Israeli Air Force jets responded by blowing up several sites in Gaza. Palestinian Chairman Mahmoud Abbas told a delegation from Jerusalem that there will be no peace between Palestine and Israel without Eastern Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Abbas said that this demand would be made at a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who is trying to broker a peace agreement with them. This is really cool. You got to listen to this one. Israel Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said in a closed conversation ahead of Kerry's meeting that the American security plan that was presented is not worth the paper it's written on, unquote. Secretary of State John Kerry came with a messianic feeling, still quoting, the only thing that can save us is that John Kerry will get a Nobel Peace Prize and leave us alone. This, of course, caused a hue and outcry in the Department of State here in America, at which point Minister Alone's office issued an apology saying, I am sorry I hurt your feelings. Yes. As my daughter would say, that the next line is usually, now go to your mama and cry. Anyway, Jews throughout Morocco responded to the plea of King Mohammed VI and prayed for rain this past Sabbath. Moroccan Jews performed prayers in all the synagogues in the country, imploring God to spread bountiful rain on the entire territory of the kingdom. It rained today. Serious thunderstorms in Morocco. Go take that one to the bank. That's really cool. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program. Running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. I am online with Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman. We're talking about Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers of Language and Culture. How are you both?
Great. Thanks for having us on your show.
Good to hear. That's always good. I like doing two people. That way I get to juggle them both before. Okay, so the reason I came across this book, I wouldn't call it accidental. It was sort of like I went looking for it because I'm working at Wayne, State University and made a proposal to the language department and to the Judaic Studies department that it's about time that Wayne State University has a course in Yiddish. And they said, well, put one together, you know. What kind of textbooks are there? What's it? So I went to the Wayne State. There I'm in Wayne State, and I'm in their server, and I typed in the word Yiddish textbooks. And lo and behold, published by Wayne State University, which neither one of you went to, is Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers of Language and Culture. So that's how I got to come to your book. And I said, this is great. And I got it, and I looked through it, and I said, this is great, and we have to talk about this on the radio show, which is another thing that I do. So, Lara, tell us about like a little of the history behind what compelled you, if you were felt compelled, to writing Choosing Yiddish.
Well, I'll say first off that your story kind of encapsulates one of the reasons that we ended up putting together this edited volume. We noticed. Three of us, along with Shiri Gorin, were graduate students at New York University's Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies. And around 2006, we organized a Yiddish Studies Conference, and we thought it would be a small gathering of graduate students, just a small seminar, and we were overwhelmed with submissions, and we realized that we had tapped into something much larger, which you sort of also... I think are realizing in that in 2013 or 14, you wanted to put together a Yiddish course at Wayne State University. I mean, everyone thought Yiddish was a dying language, and here we were in the sort of academic realm, and Yiddish studies was booming. So we ended up putting together a three-day conference. We received 100 or 200 submissions from all around the world. We got picked up by the press all over New York, including the New York Times, for this humble graduate student conference. So at the end of the conference, and it was, I think by all accounts, successful, we decided we had to, and many people told us we had to, put together a volume. In the ensuing couple of years, we realized that what we had tapped into was a part of a greater moment where young scholars, in particular the sort of emerging scholars, were looking to Yiddish studies as an innovative field within all kinds of disciplines in academia. So we sort of brought in the book's appeal to sort of capture this moment that we had sort of become a part of unwillingly or unbeknownst to us. None of us were Yiddish studies scholars per se. We were all plugged into Yiddish studies in through our different avenues, but we realized there was a sort of a renaissance of Yiddish studies happening in the academy through all different disciplines, and we decided to put together a book that reflects that. So I think that's what we've done.
Excellent.
I know Anna agrees with me.
Excellent. So
I think that is a great history of our book, Lara. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. So it sounds from talking to both of you beforehand that neither one of you would be, I suppose, called first language Yiddish speakers. Would that be correct?
Native speakers, you mean?
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Because when
I grew up with part Ashkenazi and part Sephardic roots and heard scattered Yiddish words, you know, the typical things, punim and polkas and terms of endearment from my grandparents who hailed from a shtetl in Lithuania, but it was all in a very domestic, you know, family context, and so it was a language that felt familiar and comfortable when I started studying in an academic context. The summer after my first year of graduate school, I did a YIVO summer program in New York City. That was the beginning. So I had, you know, a very light basis. Really, though, learned it from scratch. It helped that I had a very strong basis in Hebrew language. My field is Hebrew literature, so I had the alphabet and that core of Hebrew words that is part of the Yiddish language, but no, definitely didn't start out as a native speaker.
Mm-hmm. So as Sephardic parents one side, as grandparents one side, Yiddish parents the other, so you basically grew up sort of like with Ladino-ish, then I guess.
Well, I actually didn't have that much Ladino in the home either. My mother didn't. She said her grandmother and the aunties would speak Ladino when they were cooking, but it wasn't a language that they really taught so much to the younger generation. So I'm actually studying Ladino now as my one of my new Jewish languages that I'm trying to acquire. I'm studying it at the University of Washington with Professor David Dunas, who's visiting the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's a world expert in Ladino. So it's been interesting learning that another Jewish language that has been perceived to be rare, that is experiencing its own kind of micro boom, kind of like the Yiddish boom of the early 21st century, I think, perhaps on a smaller scale. So, but I digress.
Yeah, no, that's fine. When I also grew up with Yiddish in the background. I wish I spoke Yiddish like my mother, who was native. She didn't learn how to speak English until she was 5 years old, even if she was born in Newark. But Yiddish was always the Sprache der Rebbe gerät zu der Babi, the Kinder soll nicht verstehen. That the parents and the grandparents would talk so that the kids wouldn't understand. Until one day I hear one of my aunts saying, Rednish is Herschel versteht, yeah. So, because I did pick it up. So, Lara, talk about that a little bit. Why was there this reluctance among the immigrants and the first generation ones to convey such a rich cultural heritage such as the Yiddish language to our generation?
Well, first of all, it wasn't even really called Yiddish. It was called Jewish for a long time in the immigrant communities in the United States and Canada. So can you imagine coming to this country, trying to assimilate and being, speaking a language called Jewish? It's part of the classic immigrant story of shedding layers and making yourself anew and absorbing the language of the mainstream, which in this country is English, of course. So Yiddish is part of that classic immigrant story, or the decline of Yiddish is part of that classic immigrant story. And what's interesting about this book is that it's we're not really, even though we have chapters and authors who wrote about Yiddish, speaking Yiddish and what it, the actual language as a spoken language, all of the contributors in this book, or many of the contributors in this book, are like us. They acquired a language as graduate students or at some point in their lives. I think there's very, very, very small, if at all, group that grew up speaking Yiddish or understanding Yiddish. So it's kind of also part of that immigrant second, third, fourth generation immigrant story as well, in that classically the first generation, wants to assimilate, the generation that follows or the generation that follows that wants to recapture what has been lost. So in a way, that's part of the reason that some of our contributors, including me, and I might be speaking for him as well, were sort of interested or piqued in Yiddish in the first place. But what I think distinguishes this book, and what I think is the reason that it's having this renaissance in the academy, is that what a lot of these scholars learned along the way is that Yiddish opens up all kinds of interesting avenues for research and exploration in the sort of nexus between different disciplines, between literature, between history, between film studies, between cultural studies, between linguistics. And that Yiddish sort of has this way, or it kind of comes up in all these different places because it was so, it was the language of the Jewish people, of millions of people, until very recently. So if you kind of tap into that culture and into that past, you are not only sort of, tapping into something that might be nostalgic or whatever, but also something that opens up a whole world and a whole people that I hope that we've tried to capture at least in part in this book through all the different disciplines that our book touches upon.
It's interesting that you mentioned multi-disciplines as far as the teaching of Yiddish, because my first idea in approaching someone is a person I thought would, who, if I want to teach a language course, the person I should go talk to at Wayne would be the head of the language department. And the head of the language department said, it's a really good idea, but we can't do it alone because of budget constraints. We need to get also somebody else involved. Who else do you think might be willing to pick this up? I said, well, there's the Judaic Studies department. He said, that's a good idea. So now we have the language department and the Judaic Studies department together. Mm-hmm. But they said, you're looking at a class, you'll probably get 8, 10, 12 people. It's not going to be really sexy enough for the administration to say, let's put money into this. Maybe we can get somebody else involved. So it says, okay. The history department, and this history, so we got this history teacher, history professors now on board with this whole thing, and so It's Yiddish is sort of like it's we're touching on this question that people ask me all the time about Judaism and Jewish. Is Jewish a religion, a philosophy, a people, a socio-economic group? What is Yiddish? Let's back up a bit. And for people maybe not familiar with this this concept, the whole development of Yiddish, and the reason why I want to say this is when I first, I got thrown into Yiddish immersion, basically, because I went to a yeshiva in the third year. If you didn't know Yiddish, you didn't understand what was going on. So the first year, I went to one of the rabbis, and I said, could you give me the basic principles in Yiddish grammar? And he said, there's one rule in Yiddish grammar, and I'm quoting, if it sounds like Yiddish, it's correct. If it doesn't, it's not. So if you, I don't know if you came across such things from people who are native speakers, but if you could elaborate, please, either Hannah or Lara, as to the structure of the Yiddish language.
That'll be a question for Hannah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Yiddish has its origins in the Rhine River Valley in medieval times. And, you know, Uriel Weinreich, I really defer to his great sociolinguistic history of the English language for anyone who, of the Yiddish language, rather, for anyone who wants to really grasp the origins of the language. But it has a very strong, what's interesting about it, which we kind of use it as a metaphor for why, for the, what's exciting about Yiddish in the academy today is that Yiddish has as its a certain, you know, corpus of language, and it has a strong, you know, influence from the Romance languages, from where it started geographically, and then moved. It moved all over, and everywhere that it moved, it picked up local vocabulary, local linguistic and grammatical features, and layered them in. So it picked up Slavic components, for example, when the people speaking Yiddish moved in that direction, and so on. And it has this capacity to sort of fuse with other languages and cultures wherever it goes. And so this idea of Yiddish as, on the one hand, having boundaries, it was very obviously tied to the Jewish community where people spoke it, where the Yiddish agas is the expression for the Jewish street, literally, also kind of means, you know, the perspective of the Jewish community as a whole. What are the Jewish people, what were they saying on the Jewish street? What was the view of the Jewish people? So that this idea of the Jewish street as being, on one hand, bounded in you know, these physical neighborhoods where Jews lived in Europe and in Russia. On the other hand, Yiddish sort of leapt across those boundaries and enabled Jews to mix and speak with the people that they were in contact with. So it really is this kind of feature of language contact where it could absorb parts of other kinds of other languages, but at the same time maintain a distinct Jewish identity because there was a very strong Hebrew and Aramaic layer, the Loishen Kodesh layer, right, that came from the, you know, sacred canon. And so it has a very distinct identity. It's very Jewish. On the other hand, it's syncretic, and it combines with other languages and other cultures. And it's a language of many different cities and many different countries. And it's an international language. But we also, the Jewish community, has a very particular association with it, a very particular, you know, love of it. It's the Mama Loshen. It's the most intimate and familiar language at the same time. So I think it's that sort of multivalent identity that we were so fascinated by in our studies of it, and that it kind of is a metaphor for what all of these different emerging scholars are doing too. They're recognizing that Yiddish is so special because it is so integrally tied to Jewish identity and the Jewish community on the one hand, but also has this history of hopping from place to place, from the Jewish street on out to the non-Jewish community, you know, taking language elements and idioms from other cultures, incorporating them back in. And that is, I think, what makes it such a fascinating language.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. If you're just tuning in, our guests today are Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman. We've written a book, Choosing Yiddish. We're talking about Yiddish, New Frontiers of Languages and Language and Culture, printed by Detroit's own Wayne State University Press. Let me continue on that with Heidi. The homogenization of all of these languages together, the amalgam that became Yiddish, it didn't happen in, so you mentioned that your family is on one side Sephardic. It didn't happen in the Sephardic communities. People who speak Ladino coming from Spain don't understand people who speak Ladino who came from Italy, who don't speak Ladino that came from North Africa. So why is it with Yiddish that it did work?
I mean, why could people overcome the sort of a different regional dialect?
Yes.
To a greater extent. You know, I don't know that much about the regional dialects of Ladino. As I said, I'm just starting out in my journey into the world of Judeo-Spanish, so I can't answer the comparative.
Okay. Keep me posted and have me in mind when you get to that point. I would like to know.
Sure,
but
thing.
Anyway, Lara, do you speak Yiddish?
I read it much better than I speak it, to be honest.
Okay.
I, you know, really see it as an academic language, much like Latin. Although there are many native speakers of Yiddish today, especially in the religious and Orthodox communities, I really see it as an academic language.
Mm-hmm.
So I read it. Yes. I can speak it a little, and I can.
Okay. My mother took umbrage with the Yiddish word for sweater. Do you know what the Yiddish word for sweater is? Either one of you? No. It's sweder. Okay. And she said she didn't like that. And especially, I for a while was in Australia, and in Australia, they don't call a sweater, they call it a jumper. And the Yiddish word that the native speakers were speaking in Australia, when they were cold and they needed to put something on, they put on a jumper. So I want to talk a little bit about this. If we can talk about this again, there's more this fluidity, and is it still called Yiddish? I remember when I was learning Yiddish, and because Yiddish is not native to me, so I want to find out if I'm translating something. I want to find out the Yiddish word for it. So I remember sitting in the cafeteria in school, and two guys are talking. And these are both native Yiddish American speakers. And one of them says, "Kannst du gehen zu store for mir and kaufen a pack of cigarettes?" Which means, could you go to the store and buy a pack of cigarettes for me? And I just looked at this guy and said, "Are you speaking Yiddish?" Because you have the word store, which I would say the word crumb, and you have the word cigarettes, which I would say papyrusen. So at what point does Yiddish, is it American Yiddish, or is it European Yiddish, Israeli Yiddish? You know, so I don't know which one of you would like to tackle that question.
Well,
you
know, I'll just say that,
sorry.
Okay.
No, it's fine. Go ahead, Lara.
Well, you know, one of our contributors in the book is Sarah Benor, and she has a chapter about how English is increasingly, you know, part of the Yiddish language, but also how increasingly Yiddish is part of English. So, you know, I think that is a fascinating study to look at if you look at our book. And she found through sociological studies, she specializes in Yiddish linguistics, and she partnered with a sociologist, and they did this study where they discovered that increasingly Yiddish words are actually being incorporated into the English language.
Sure, who doesn't know what a bagel is, of course.
Well, I mean, but even Yiddishisms like, do you want to eat by us, instead of do you want to eat at our house? That's increasingly, she found, something that especially American Jews are incorporating into the English language.
Is that really true?
Just English becomes... as much as Yiddish is always borrowing from other languages, Yiddish is always, as anyone in this country probably knows, being fused with chutzpah into the English language as well. So I think, you know, that is interesting. But I also think one thing sort of more recently that's happened in the Yiddish language is that Evo in the 20th century came to the fore and codified a lot of the grammar and Yiddishisms and all these things you've been talking about. So I think that would be my suggestion. And we certainly have two chapters on the origins of Yivo and the Weinreich family and how that process of codification and teaching about Yiddish and teaching Yiddish in this country, beginning in Europe and then in this country, happened and continues to happen. So I think they would probably be the best people to answer some of those sort of more linguistic questions, or, you know, that would be where I would refer you to our book and to YIVO.
Indeed. Could you add to that, please, Hannah Pressman?
Yes, absolutely. Just to follow up on your question, you know, who the Yiddish is it anyway? And everyone thinks that they have the authentic or correct version of Yiddish, right? So that anecdote about Sveder and, you know, feeling like that was the wrong term, that I think that's very revealing. And it reminded me of the spelling bee controversy last year. I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah, we reported about that. And I really went to town. What was it? Knadel. I said, how could you possibly codify and say the knadel has to be spelled that way when I would spell it with an I, you'd spell it with an E, you spell it with a Y.
Right. So the aforementioned Sarah Benor had a piece on the Jewish Journal, which is available online, where she said people came to her to sort of rule, like King Solomon, which is the right spelling of knadel. You know, she's a linguist, so she should have the definitive spelling. And she found that there were, I think, about a dozen different ways legitimately that one could spell the word knadel, right? And people had these very visceral reactions to the story about the spelling bee, saying, you know, I wouldn't have spelled it that way. You know, I always spell it, you know, my grandmother and her recipes would write it out this way. Like, people had this very strong attachment to the language and feel that their way or their grandparents' way or their mother's way is the Yiddish way. And it's, I think, proof of the sort of emotional power of the language, that people have this, you know, even to a question of, you know, is it knadel, E-Y-E-I-D-L, you know, how do you spell it properly? That people reacted quite violently and said, no, I would never spell knadel that way. I don't know if there are many other languages in the world that would generate such responses, but I do recommend Sarah Benor's article in the Jewish Journal, the linguist take on the knadel controversy, that really encapsulates that whole phenomenon last year with the spelling bee.
I actually took umbrage with that. They even suggested that they would use the word knadel because it's an American English spelling bee, and the word knadel is not an American English word. It was like sort of like, wait a minute, you're stealing from us. I felt personally violated by it. Anyway,
I in a bowl of chicken soup.
Yeah, indeed. That's where a knadel belongs. A knadel is a matzo ball for those people who don't speak Yiddish, and it belongs in a bowl of soup. One of the things that caught me about the book is on the title. I think on the cover, which I think it's a terrific cover. It's called Choosing Yiddish. And if, by the way, if you're just choosing, and we're speaking with the authors of Choosing Yiddish, Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman, it's somebody standing at an ATM, and they have a chance of choosing English, Espanol, which is written with the little nya over the N, Yiddish, which is written in Yiddish, and I'm assuming that's Chinese, the last one, since I don't read Chinese, and it says Chinese and Chinese. I always spelled Yiddish with an aleph at the front. I know this is very anal, but you spell Yiddish with a yud at the front, so yours is more Yiddish, and mine is more Yiddish. So talking about spelling bees, is there a spelling controversy on how to actually spell the word Yiddish?
We went with the YIVO spelling, which is the standard Yiddish spelling today. It's by no means necessarily the only spelling, and we just went with the most common and the most, the codified Yiddish, which is YIVO Yiddish throughout the book, including the cover.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, but in YIVO, I think they spell the word Yid with an aleph at the front. No? We could go look it up. We could go look it up, but I think it does.
Yeah.
And if it has a yid, which means a Jew, has an aleph at the front. But anyway, I'm waxing, like I say. That's really anal of me. But okay.
We chose that image, though, as, you know, very intentionally, and we worked with a really great artist who was a student of the cartoonist and graphic artist Harvey Pekar. And what we wanted to convey with that whole ATM image was this idea, first of all, that the generation of scholars that we're highlighting in the book are consciously, intentionally choosing Yiddish over other language options as part of their graduate work, that they are opting into the language. It wasn't necessarily something they grew up with, but they're choosing it and benefiting from it in their work because it is such a dynamic language. And then also what we wanted to convey was this idea of a sort of academic marketplace and the idea of Yiddish as a currency, as something that can be used and exchanged in the in the marketplace of ideas, right? So we wanted to convey as well this sort of financial metaphor of what Yiddish can do in the sort of marketplace of ideas.
Mm-hmm. This will be the final question because we're actually over time, but I'm just having such a good time, and I hope you two are, and I hope all of our listeners are. Way back when people were thinking about starting a country called Israel, there was a conscientious decision to move away from Yiddish and to speak Hebrew specifically. And indeed, this country which we call Israel, the language that they speak, the national language there, is Hebrew. And Yiddish is not, it's not even like a second language. It doesn't appear on documents. It's not anything, it's not a consideration. Most Israelis do not speak Yiddish. And now, traveling around the world, I'm not such a world traveler, but my wife is, and she's finding now that she gets around better from going from place to place, which it used to be that if you went to some place and you didn't know the language, you'd go find a Jew and you'd speak Yiddish to it. Now she's finding that if she has to go find a Jew, she has to speak Hebrew to the person. So if either one of you could talk about this competition that Hebrew has in taking over or usurping, or this, maybe, is it a war yet, between what is the mother tongue of Jews, Hebrew or Yiddish?
I'm going to let Hannah answer the question, but I just want to give a shout-out to Joseph Remnant, because he's the cover artist who designed our beautiful cover and drew it. But I also just want to say, before Hannah really tackles the question, is that we have an entire rubric devoted to the language wars, the quote-unquote language wars between Hebrew and Yiddish that occurred during those early years in the founding of the state, and I think Hannah could probably better talk about that than I can, though.
Yeah, so the phenomenon you're referring to is the Riv HaLashonot or Mechamet HaSafot. Both can be translated as the language quarrel or the language war or battle, you know, all these military metaphors for the relationship between Hebrew and Yiddish, and this is a topic that I've written about. It's kind of a huge question, so I think we can only kind of tackle the tip of the iceberg. Would you like me to speak more about the historical phenomenon of the, you know, in the early 20th century of the sort of
make it modern. Like, where are we up to now in this?
Okay. And Hannah, why don't you talk a little bit about the chapters in the book? I mean, that do justice. I think that, you know, to cover this very well in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Israel is particularly interesting, I think, because there is, in fact, even though Hebrew has quote-unquote won in terms of being the language of the state of Israel officially, there is quite a Yiddish revival going on in Israel right now in terms of heritage, people embracing that heritage and learning Yiddish. The phenomenon of going back to Eastern Europe to examine Holocaust history, that's already been going on for.
Let me just interrupt. Would you say that's paralleling what's going on in America, the same type of a thing? These are like the grandchildren of the immigrants that came to Israel, the grandchildren of immigrants who came to America are trying to go back to the Yiddish?
Right. Anna? So there is now that, you know, the state of Israel has been established and that sort of the future of the Jewish people is a little more stable than it was, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. Now that there is that sort of sense of security, I think that people feel permission in a way to go back to the diaspora, to embrace the culture of the shtetl and Yiddish and Eastern Europe, which felt, I think, in the formative years of when Israel was being established, it felt not so permissible because there was that need to establish the sort of the collective Hebrew culture and that the identity of the state. So there is a kind of opening up and a relaxation and an embrace of that heritage that is complicated. And Ladino is part of that picture too, by the way. Ladino has been recognized now as a Jewish language in the state of Israel. And so I think that is a really fascinating piece of, you know, the 21st century picture of Yiddish is what, you know, and something to think about, you know, maybe for our next volume, right, Lara? What is going to happen to Yiddish identity when it's, you know, when it has become part of this popular resurgence in different pockets around the world? And what is going to be its identity when, on the one hand, you know, the world of the shtetl has disappeared. It exists, you know, in our nostalgia and our imagination. But on the other hand, there are communities who and individuals who are connecting with Yiddish in these really new and creative ways, and sort of creating these new virtual landscapes for Yiddish communities. So I think that's something that scholars are going to have to reckon with going forward.
Terrific. Okay, that's going to do it. I could really devote the whole hour of the show to it, maybe more. But so, and you answered my last question. Is there going to be a son of Choosing Yiddish, maybe frontiers already crossed of language and culture?
There'll be a daughter, and it'll be called Choosing Ladino.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, that's going to do it. Our guests have been Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Presson, and together with Shiri Gorin, who was teaching today at this time. Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers of Language and Culture, Wayne University Press. I felt smarter. That's the type of book that this is, and I recommend it highly. So thank you so much for coming on.
I hope your course materializes, and I hope that the book is useful.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968. MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman, you're listening to The Jewish Hour. I wish, I really do, I wish I could do something called Der Yiddische Stunde, which would be The Jewish Hour in Yiddish, und red die ganze Zeit Yiddish, and just speak Yiddish the whole time. But I would have a listening audience of maybe 12. So, unfortunately, Yiddish is not there yet. You know, people were counting it out. They were saying it's dead. And it in the last minutes, in the throes of death, and the death rattle was definitely upon the Yiddish language, suddenly somebody came with the defibrillators and resuscitated it. And now it's on life support at this point still, but it's in stable condition. So we'll see one day, you know, maybe, you know, if this course at Wayne gets through and enough people take it and they want to hear Yiddish auf der Radio. That's how you like that for a good Yiddish radio, a good Yiddish word. How do you say radio in Yiddish? Radio. Anyway, we don't have a Yiddish song up next. This is Misha Gammerman. This is Adon Olam, which means master of the world. Let's listen in.
חושב ומתבונן עליך בורא עולם מודה אני לפניך טובות רבות עושה אתה לברואך נבוא כולם נספר את תהילותיך אדון עולם, תודה, אני אוהב אותך. אדון עולם, שלום לכל בניך. כבר מצפים מתי ישועתך. Thank you.
assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. We have time for one more song. This is the incomparable Shlomo Carlebach, Leman Achai, recorded live from Paris in 1970, and it's just for you.
Leman Achai V'Re'ai. Leman Achai V'Re'ai. Adabrana.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Fidman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. The portion of the week this week is Mishpatim, which is chapter 21 of the book of Exodus and following. For those of you who are following along at home, the majority of the portion deals with very basic civil law. Fair weights and measures, stealing, tort law, which means damages that you hurt. If you break something, you got to pay for it, all this kind of stuff. At the end of the portion, there's a bit of philosophy, some encouragement from the Almighty, because, and it's here, because we don't just do things because they make sense to us. We do things because of the encouragement of God. God says, this is the way it's got to be. And then there's a quid pro quo. God says, I'll take care of you. You take care of me. What does it say? This is in chapter 23, verse 26. There shall not be any miscarriages or barren women in your land. And your number of your days I will fill. The dread of you I will send before you, and nations will be sort of like melt away from you. They'll turn around. You'll see the backs of their necks, is the translation. I'm looking at a Hebrew. This is something the Almighty promises us. He says you're going to get taken care of. God's basically saying, I want something done. You want something done. You do what I want. I want the world to be a better place. Make it such that people feel comfortable and safe and happy. You know, it's an interesting thing that in our present-day culture, we live in these things called unwalled cities because we're not worried about the hordes and the marauders coming through in the middle of the night and chopping off our heads, which was so common throughout the millennia. We live in a state of security and surety. And the Almighty says you'll be able to do that if you have your society as set. If everything's just the way it's supposed to be, you'll be able to sleep at night. And I got your back. I've been saying this already for weeks already. God says, I got your back. Whatever it is that you're going to need, I'm going to take care of you. To the extent that you're not even going to have to lift a finger. And that would be true for all of us. I've said to people, listen, you don't need to work. If you honestly believe that God was going to pay you for sitting at home, you would get paid. Okay? Why is it that I work? Because I don't believe that that's going to happen. I'm sort of like from the small of little, as they say, ye of little faith. I have to make an appeal at the end of the show because the show's not paying for itself. So, but take care of what the Almighty wants. The Almighty will take care of what you want. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard from the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Fidman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Go to rabbifinman.com. Right there on the homepage, you click the button over there. It sends you into the mail part of the website. You type in your address. You tell me what you're talking about. You send me a letter. I get it. I send you a letter, and everybody lives happily ever after. You'll also find archives editions of the show. This was a long interview. Maybe you missed a little bit of it. It was a really good stuff. It'll be there for a month. If you want to tell somebody else about it, go listen to this really awesome interview that Fidman had this week. Yep, it'll be there starting sometime this afternoon when I get around to posting it to the website. I have to do that myself, yours truly, because my webmaster doesn't do that because he would charge me, and that would mean I would need you to send more money. So, which is why I'm talking to you right now, is it's the middle of January, And we're not even close to paying for January yet. And I've actually gone to the station manager and I've said, I don't know about January. January is always a tough month because December everybody gave. And they'll listen, hey, you know, so I gave December. And I appreciate December, we actually paid off. The last week of December, we paid November and December in December. That's how good a month December was. So January, it's like, you know, do it. There are people out there listening. I know there's a lot of people listening to the Jewish Hour that didn't go to RabbiFinman.com and hit the donation page and contribute whatever it was, anywhere from a dollar to infinity. It's fine. You could give less than a dollar, but you couldn't do it on the website because it doesn't recognize it. So if you wanted to send me pennies, you'd have to do that by sending your donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. And by the way, if you have a vehicle, a boat, or something of value, if somebody once gave me exercise equipment, I was able everything has to be in working condition. I was able to turn it over, put it on eBay, Craigslist, whatever it was, and it all went into the coffers. Thank you very much. It doesn't have to be funds. It could be stuff, just as long as it's in good working condition. 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. One of my favorite Baal Shem Tov stories involves a couple. His name was Moshe, her name was Sarah. They went to the Baal Shem Tov when they were first married. They wanted a blessing for children. Year goes by, they have no children. They come back to the Baal Shem Tov, they want a blessing for children. No blessing for children. He blesses them that they should be wealthy. Next year goes by. They are very wealthy and no kids. They come back. They want a blessing for children. This goes on for 5 years already. So, and they're doing quite well. The business is prospering and they're both very healthy. No kids. They came the fifth year. They were like crying. The Baal Shem Tov says, what are you crying about? You have good health. You have a livelihood. You're become supporters of institutions. This is a wonderful thing you're doing. He says, we want children. He said, I'm going on a trip and I'd like you to come with me. This is an honor to go with the Rebbe. Wow. So they traveled, who knows, some village they traveled to. And they got out and there's some kids playing. And the Baal Shem Tov went over to the kid. And he said, excuse me, what's your name? And the kid said, well, my name is Baruch Moshe. And he said, okay, that's very nice. And what's your name? And he said, my name is also Baruch Moshe. And he said, third kid, he says, what's your name? And he said, my name is Mordechai Baruch. And the third, said, everything was like, there's either a Baruch or Moshe in the name. And then one little girl piped up and she said, my name is Bracha Leah. And he said, that's very nice. And they walked around and said, there's another girl. And what's your name? My name is Bracha Leah. And again, it was the same thing. The names had in it the name Bracha and Leah. All the kids. They came into a shul and they said, one of the synagogues, and said, what gives? How come all the kids in this city have the same name? He said, let me tell you. He says, there was a young man who lived here in this town about 100 years ago. He was well-to-do. He was a butcher, which was a good job in the shtetl. And unfortunately, he wasn't very learned as far as book learning goes. He knew how to butcher. He wasn't a shaykhet. Shaykhet, you got to know your stuff. He knew how to cut a piece of meat. And he was very upset that he didn't have any kids. And so he's sitting in synagogue one day. He's listening to a class. And the rabbi says, if you can teach somebody to learn Torah, so that's like you gave birth to them. And like you'd be fulfilled the mitzvah of having kids that way. So he says, great. He says, here it is. I can't learn and I can't have any kids, so I'm never going to have kids. So the rabbi said to him, no, that's not what I meant. It means if you support people to learn Torah, then it'll be as though you gave birth to them as well. So he undertook that he was going to support all of the school learning. They basically turned it into a public school, and it was all on his tab. And out of consideration, so for like the next 100 years, everybody in this city, and he set up an endowment even, everybody in this city named their kids something to do, Baruch Moshe or Bracha Leah. So the Baal Shem Tov said to them, you see where I'm going with this? And they understood. Sometimes, you know, we pray to God, we want, we want, we want. The Almighty knows better. He says, no, you can't have. It's not for you. It's not in your best interest. I'm not giving it. So they also, they did the same thing. They supported institutions. And from what I understand, that the institutions that this couple supported were in existence from the times of the Baal Shem Tov until the beginning of World War II, when the Nazis and Mashimo destroyed that village. That's going to do it for the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you again next week. Take care.